Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today we're speaking with Dr. Ansley T. Erickson and Dr. Ernest Morrell, the co-editors of a new volume entitled Educating Harlem, A Century of Schooling and Resistance in a Black Community. Dr. Erickson is an associate professor of history and education policy at Teachers College, Columbia University, and Dr. Morrell is the Coyle Professor of Literacy Education at the University of Notre Dame. Educating Harlem is a volume that draws on the multidisciplinary expertise of a group of scholars to present the rich history of education in Harlem. Dr. Erickson and Dr. Morrell, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
So I think the importance of the history of Harlem as the Black Mecca of New York and the United States is well known. So what drew you to examine the history of education in Harlem? For example, you talk about the Harlem Education History Project. How does this work draw upon that work, and how does it also push it forward?
Yeah, thank you for the question. And just first of all, thank you, Chris. Ansley and I are really excited for this opportunity to discuss the book. I think we began our collaboration with a larger question that ultimately kind of morphed into the question for this book. And we come from different disciplinary perspectives, but I think each of us is interested in this question of, at least as it relates to educational research, who gets to tell a story? And how does that affect what stories get told, and who's included and who's not included, and in what ways? So we began a conversation about history and history of urban education, and really thinking about who gets to tell the history of education in cities, and of whom does this story get told. And we were both really influenced by a scholar named Michelle Trio, who talks about the silence of the archive. And that doesn't necessarily mean that archives are silent, but they often silence, and certain people are silenced in those archives. And we really began to think about what a history from within would sound like, or some would call it a social history or a critical history or history from a post-colonial perspective that includes often muted voices, both in terms of the stories that get told, but also who tells the stories. I think that really connects to the Harlem Education History Project, which began, again, its collaboration with Angela and I and students who were participating in the institute that I directed. And we started a project in Los Angeles before I came to New York that involved young people as makers of educational research, young people as not just the objects of research, but the participators. And when I moved to New York, we really began to think about, what that might look like in terms of, young people. And then with Ansley's help, community actors in general being participants in the creation of history, and how that might lead to different narratives if we have different participants on both sides of the telling. So that gets to the question of kind of why Harlem. I think the why is important for all the reasons that you mentioned. It's notoriety is a Black Mecca, being the focal point of what we call the Harlem Renaissance. That was really important to us, but I think it was also our proximity to Harlem, and in some ways as university researchers from Columbia University, you can be the consummate outsider in the neighborhood that you're juxtaposed to. And we recognize those tensions, but it was a place that we were proximal to logistically. We were residents, we were faculty members. We had been involved in projects with young people, with the schools, with community advocates. It seemed like a really good place to begin to think about how one might tell a story differently about education in a particular city, in the early, mid 20th century. So we were really excited about that opportunity. It's useful for us for a lot of ways, just because of the how visible Harlem is to people. But I think what was most important is that it was the community where we found ourselves as residents and as scholars.
So this project has evolved over many years, and it's and I appreciate hearing Ernest's characterization of these early conversations, like all the way back in 2011, 2012, when we started thinking about working together on this. The project has had a lot of arms, and in one arm is the edited volume that we are happy to just be releasing, and that represented, you know, drawing together scholars from who were in institutions all over the country, some of them very senior people, some of them graduate students, to bring together their scholarly contributions to the edited volume. But one of the great things about working locally, like Ernest was describing, is that we had the chance to think about other connections to that idea of a more participatory and a more community engaged history. And so through the work of a graduate student that Ernest and I both advised, Barry Goldenberg, we saw a project called Youth Historians in Harlem develop, which involved young people in an after-school context in conducting research on their own communities. And then gradually in conversation with other school alumni or veteran teachers, we saw a couple of opportunities open up for ongoing oral history projects. And so the volume doesn't directly represent those pieces, but it's definitely the case that all of our thinking about the volume sort of grew up in that multi-part conversation about lots of people and from various positions thinking about Harlem's education history.
So one of the themes that struck me is that when you're telling the story of a community, especially one with the significance and richness of Harlem, there are going to be several twists and turns that may not perfectly align with what we would expect of an urban community. And you begin this book by describing the rise and fall framework as a popular lens that's often used to understand the history of large urban school districts. For listeners who may not be familiar with the rise and fall narrative, what is this historical interpretation of schools? And how do your findings and the findings of the scholars in this book push back on the narrative that Harlem had a period of rise and then a period of falling?
So this is drawing from the notion of the rise and fall really comes out of several scholarly works that have tried to tell the story of the 20th century urban school system. The early 20th century, the turn of the 19th to the early 20th century, is the time period in which we really come to have a thing that looks like an urban school system, largely on the model that still exists today. And a lot of historians looking either at single city cases or across cities nationally described the early 20th century as the period of time in which this urban system gets built. It becomes bureaucratically elaborate, it's professionalized, city school systems grow tremendously in the first few decades of the century to serve more and more kids. And so this is a period when it seems like the system is being built, and in a lot of people's description is rising because it's serving more people. The implication is that it's serving them increasingly well, and that's the story of the sort of pre-World War II city system. And then in the post-World War II years, there's a story of the fall of the system, that that the challenges of urban disinvestment that hit cities across the country, combined with the consequences of departures from the city by middle class and predominantly white residents, create a context that in which cities systems fell. That's the framework that I'm trying to offer in a very general terms. When you look not just at cities in general, but when you put an African-American neighborhood at the center, that narrative doesn't really work anymore. One reason it doesn't work is that we see that Harlem was never treated fairly in the New York City educational landscape. So that from the perspective of Harlem, there was never that period of intense investment and system building and rise that the rise and fall narrative would convey. But just as importantly, even in the years of urban disinvestment and real struggle in city contexts, the fall narrative overgeneralizes in another dangerous way. It seems to suggest that all that's going on in city systems after the 1950s and 1960s is a sort of story of decline. And what we want to suggest instead is that there's a story of perpetual struggle. And that struggle was present by Harlem residents trying to get their appropriate share of the city's resources in the quote unquote rise period, and it continues very vibrantly in the period that sometimes that's too frequently characterized as the period of the fall.
So I'd like to move to providing some of the examples that are presented in the book. Ansley, in your chapter on youth participation in schooling and activism, you described the history of the Harlem Youth Opportunities Unlimited youth organization. And I think it's in chapter 10 where Nick Yurovich describes the community-based paraprofessional educators. You explain that these ideas had varied success in Harlem, but you nonetheless argue that the influence of Harlem can still be felt both inside and outside of Harlem today. So why were these programs and organizations so important within Harlem when they were first implemented? And what does the prevalence of these policies and organizations today tell us about the ability of schools to draw on the assets that exist within their communities?
It's interesting to think about these two particular chapters next to each other. I appreciate that pairing. I think that both of them are important both within Harlem and beyond Harlem for reasons that you hint at the end of your question, and that notion of drawing on the assets that that exist within their communities. HARU was one of the very first of what become the national War on Poverty community action programs. HARU wasn't that, but it was a precursor for those programs. And the premise there was that rather than outside experts or agencies designing social programming to serve Harlem in the mid-1960s, that Harlem residents, and in my interest especially, young people in Harlem, children from between 14 to young adults in their early 20s, were going to be the central figures in deciding and naming and deciding and helping figure out what the neighborhood needed. And so that's very much rooted in that notion that there are assets that exist within communities in Harlem and in communities like it that need to be part of helping strengthen those communities. And that same idea carries over into Nick Yurovich's work on the creation of the paraprofessional educator. Paraprofessionals are all over American schools today. And what Nick really does is point us to the place when that idea was created. And it was created largely in Harlem and with the recognition that New York, like many city school systems, had was underrepresenting people of color in the teaching force, and that local educational expertise existed in the parents, often mothers, who were in the neighborhood and who, if they were brought into schools as employees, could serve as really important bridges between the teaching force and students in the classroom. And so, again, that's about that idea that local people have expertise that schools should connect to and build on. And that idea is what leads to the paraprofessional program as it's created in Harlem. And then the paraprofessional program expands nationally beyond that. But of course, that idea that communities hold within them assets that educators should build on, that's still a powerful idea, although it's certainly not a fully achieved one today.
So Ernest, when I often think about the ideologies and motivations behind policies and labor conflicts, for example, such as vouchers or school choice, the lack of teachers of color, or the most recent teacher strikes, I can often get caught thinking of these issues as static across time. How does the work of the various authors that contribute to this book help to complicate these notions in Harlem?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I mean, I really like how you worded it as, like, we often think of issues as static across time. And I think we've responded in a couple of the earlier questions, but our goals were really to complicate simple narratives and to think of them as non-static. And especially, I think to complicate this notion of that there being easy trajectories of progress or regression over time. We wanted to show that there, you know, the moments are complex internally and externally. They're often sites of productive debate or at least dialectic tensions. So as you mentioned, there are several chapters. I'll talk about three or four of them really quickly that push back on these notions. So the first one is a piece written by Rogers and White, and they are really looking at the arc and then challenges to the growth of the population of teachers of color in New York City. And I think one of our simple narratives would be, you know, as we increase our attention to diversity and as the country becomes more ethnically diverse, that we would have a larger cadre of teachers of color. What they're actually showing in their study is from 1972 to 1999, the proportion of Black teachers in the city actually rose, but from 2000 to 2015, we saw a decline. There were all sorts of reasons for that, but I think that kind of challenges our popular notions that the 21st century, we would expect to see an increase and we see a decrease. And so you force to ask the question, the positive question, what was happening in the 70s and 80s, stemming out of some of the civil rights movements of the 60s that led to that increase in the percentage of teachers of color and the things that they were able to do as advocates for children. But I think more poignantly, what's happening more recently that's leading to a decline? There's all sorts of ways that they talk about in the chapter. One, the proliferation of charter schools in the city is actually decreasing the diversity of our teaching force. There's another chapter by Brittany Luer who looks at Babbitt Edwards, who is a really important activist in the city. And she links the conversations about community control to Babbitt Edwards' advocacy for parental choice. And when we think about parental choice, when most of us in the educational community think about parental choice, we think of it as a largely conservative movement and not necessarily as a movement that would be started in the community by advocates. And so it forces, I think, us to think differently about that. And Babbitt Edwards was also an initial supporter of charters. And so to think about, you know, the easy liberal conservative debate in education and who controls what issues. Brittany's chapter really complicates that, I think, in productive ways. And it also, I think, one of the things that Ansley and I, you know, try to push back on is this monolithic notion of Harlem is just a singular community with one viewpoint toward education. And while there are, you know, powerful advocates, you know, from various sub-communities, there are different visions of what educational reform looks like in different moments. And I think the really productive tensions and debates about how to move forward that I think we should bring into the present. A third chapter written by Clarence Taylor really looks at teachers unions, and we kind of divide, you know, our approach to Harlem in different eras. And one of the markers is kind of what is happening before World War II and what happens coming out of World War II. And clearly, you know, in the US coming out of World War II, there's a referendum on communism, and we have the Red Scare and McCarthyism in our country in the 50s. And, you know, those issues, you know, at the federal level also begin to, you know, appear in kind of, you know, local tensions. And so Clarence Taylor's chapter is really looking at how that affected teachers' unions, and particularly this transition from the teachers' union to the teachers' guild, which was really kind of a weakened version of what was really strong or stronger, respectively, kind of teaching force in the pre-World War II era and the post-World War II. So you've got this weakened teachers' guild, and it's a movement from strength to weakness, instead of thinking of, you know, this kind of steady stream of progress and teachers having more voice now than they've ever had. We can look back to particular eras where maybe teachers were more of a force, and we can look at how external factors like a public perception of communism and teachers' unions being associated with communism actually kind of weakens the power that the teachers have in a particular era. And I think Clarence's chapter does a really good job of looking at how these kind of larger politics affect city politics and how the city of politics affect what's happening with how teachers are able to form and advocate on behalf of kids. And then a final chapter that I'll talk about, written by Craig Credell and Lisa Rabin, really looks at the Harlem Committee of the Teachers Union as early as the late 1930s. using film to encourage conversations about race and injustice. And since one of my areas is looking at curriculum and pedagogy, I was really excited about this work, looking 80 years prior to see that teachers were trying to find spaces for some conversations that we're trying to, forge today, whether it's through the lens of multiculturalism or what we would call culturally relevant pedagogy or critical pedagogy. And, these conversations are happening, in the pre-war years, but again, I mean, you've got, this kind of this swaying, of policy in one direction or another. And, what were the conditions that led the Harlem Committee to be able to do that work in the 30s and 40s? And what were the conditions that led to more conservative curricular approaches, in the 1950s, even moving into the 1960s? At any rate, I think that those that are interested in the conversation about culture and race and teaching need to look prior to the 1990s, which is when, a lot of us associated with the beginning of these movements around multiculturalism and culturally responsive pedagogy. And, we have clear evidence that these were conversations that were happening 70, 80 years ago.
Ernest, I think that's a perfect segue into the next question. So you examine Harlem's educational history into the present day. And for many of our listeners, they'll know that one of the challenges currently facing the community of Harlem is gentrification. So what role do you think that educational resources about the history of Harlem, and specifically Harlem's educational history, like the Harlem Education History Project and Educating Harlem, play in Harlem and other communities facing dramatic changes, such as those that might be posed by gentrification?
This is a great question, and I appreciate the chance to think about it. In some ways, I don't want to sound like I have any sort of sense of assurance about what the impact of the work is. I think in a lot of ways, especially with the Harlem Education History Project, the work is ongoing. And wonderfully with a book project, you sort of get to the point of publication and then you get to work on, hoping to make sure that it connects to broader public conversations. So we'll have to see how people who are not in our position as researchers, but who are community members and educators, think about this connection between the past that we're offering and the present challenges today. But I think in general, the part of the imperative for the work comes back to what Ernest was saying earlier about the power of the reality that some histories are quite actively silenced. Gentrification can feel and is often represented as a process of erasure. And that erasure can happen historically as well as in the built landscape or as, in a sense of people's community identity. And so in that way, I hope that part of what this work is doing is trying to fight against that erasure. Harlem has been an epicenter of Black educational thought for a century. And as the population of the neighborhood changes, as the neighborhood becomes more and more expensive and more exclusive, there's a real possibility that that history, as it's represented in the built environment, like what buildings are there and what buildings are not anymore, that erasure can really happen. And so the our edited volume is one way to think about trying to respond to that threat, just trying to gather together the work of multiple scholars who recognize the importance of this history, make sure it exists in a book that will be on library shelves, make sure it exists in a digital form that's widely available. But I think that we were also in the broader Harlem Education History Project trying to find ways to add to the archive of Harlem's education history. And so that's part of why we've been invested in building partnerships with community organizations or school communities that want to do oral history projects together. So there are two local school communities that we've been working with over the last several years to record oral history interviews, in some cases to involve young people from those communities in recording those interviews. And while that's not enough, there's a tremendous amount of documentation and preservation work that still needs to happen around Harlem's educational history. I think we're trying to be helpful in that effort, in that the desire that many community members have to want to hold on to this history even as it's very, visibly under threat from changes in the neighborhood. And then when you think about the neighborhood changing and the question of how these stories matter, I think that, many children who go to school in Harlem go to school in buildings with tremendously storied pasts. And yet that history might not be present in the curriculum. It might not be present in their experience of the school building. And so hopefully now that the book is out and we start to begin to try to encourage conversations about some of the stories that it contains, we can find ways to connect with teachers and classrooms and think about how it matters for young people to say, not only, I go to school in this building, but as is actually the case, right? Children go to school in a building today that was the focus of a huge and consequential parent boycott over segregation 60 plus years ago. And how can young people in that space think about that history as they understand their neighborhood, whether it's the neighborhood that their families lived in historically, or whether it's the neighborhood to which they're relative newcomers. So we've been collaborating with some local teachers around teaching some of this material in a few classrooms, and I'm hoping to see that work grow.
So I think you've already begun to answer this question throughout the interview. And I want to say, I know historians are always mindful of presentism when conducting their historical analysis, but what recommendations or lessons do you think can be taken up by educational stakeholders reading your book? And what do you hope the field of education takes away from your multidisciplinary approach to examining the history of education in Harlem?
Yeah, thank you, Chris. And I think I'll pick up on a couple of themes that Anzi just laid out in response to the last question. We definitely think that there are a lot of important takeaways. The first one, I think, is there just needs to be more critical historical work that's done. Anzi mentioned the project that she's leading with community actors that's continuing to do work in Harlem, gathering the history of Harlem through oral histories, through adding documents to the archive. That work is ongoing and there's no end in sight in Harlem, but it's also important that we think about what that might mean for other major cities across the country. Like, what does that look like in Chicago, or what does it look like in southern cities like Birmingham or Atlanta, or what might it look like out west in Los Angeles? So more of that work, and by that work we mean history that is co-created with community actors, with students, with teachers, and work that has an audience that is larger than just the academic community. I mean, we've really tried to have a digital footprint with this work, as Anthony mentioned. So that's going to be really important moving forward. But there's also something else that that Anthony mentioned, I think, is important in terms of a takeaway, is that this is not just work that is, history research for academic, to inform the academic community, but it can also be a really powerful curricular intervention. So when we, thought about initially the Harlem Education Project, we thought about this as a great way for young people not just to learn about, their community and participate in the construction of history around their community, but they're also learning academic skills that might encourage them to want to become historians, university-trained historians, but also they're learning, important academic skills that are going to help them as students in school. So the takeaway I think we'd like for those in our community to consider is how this is a really powerful pedagogical tool to get young people excited about learning about their community, but also seeing the value of accruing some of these academic skills. A third really big important takeaway, I think, is this idea of who comes to the table to discuss educational policy. And I know that's a big part of NEPC's work, and you've done really important work here, but there's power in community voice. And we need to look not just to the present, but to the past, at all the different ways that communities like Harlem have advocated for educational and racial justice in their in this case, the Harlem community, but in local communities. And how are local actors being drawn into important policy conversations is, I think, a really important question. And to look at all the ways that that has happened, what we can learn from, you know, as we think about engaging communities in the present. And a particular sub-community, I think, that is often left out is the young. So, you know, Ansley's chapter in our book about Haryu most directly relates to this. We see even 60 years ago that young people in Harlem were pulled in as researchers on, you know, a project to think about how to improve access to education in the community. And I think that young people are a largely untapped resource when it comes to policymaking. It's something that, you know, they are the most important consumers of education and often the least consulted population. So we hope that, you know, this work by looking at some of, you know, these critical incidents of the past inspires people to think differently about how young people would be engaged in the present.
Thank you, Dr. Erickson and Dr. Morrell. Educating Harlem, A Century of Schooling and Resistance in a Black Community is a wonderfully written volume, and it skillfully presents the complex history of the pursuit of educational opportunity in Harlem. It's an important reminder for scholars that the history of education should attend to the unique forces that exist across community contexts, and it's a hopeful reminder of the victories that are possible within communities that continue to pursue equitable opportunities for all children. Next month, we'll be speaking with Dr. Frank Adamson, an assistant professor in the College of Education at the California State University of Sacramento. Dr. Adamson is an expert in issues of privatization in international contexts and has begun recently to examine the prevalence of these privatization policies within the United States. As always, thanks for listening, and remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweet.